Hello, and welcome to the Institute of Leadership and Management's weekly podcast, where we round up the top stories trending in leadership and management, this week up to the 12th April 2019. I'm Carolyn Hardigo, the Institute's Communications Manager, and I'm joined by Kate Cooper, our Head of Research, Policy and Standards. Hi, Kate.
Hello, Carolyn.
Our first story focuses on the recent publication of the 2019 Gender Pay Gap figures. Concerns have emerged over the effectiveness of the legal requirement for firms to publish their gender pay gap data, with thought leaders in the world of work indicating that the still relatively new scheme has become a rote exercise for business leaders rather than a launchpad for action. In early analysis of this year's round of gender pay gap stats, the headline median gap has slightly increased, rising from 9.2% to 9.6%. CIPD CEO Peter Cheese was disappointed that many employers are still not providing a narrative or action plan. And Fawcett Society Chief Sam Smethers struck a similar note. So, Kate, are action plans the answer to closing the gap?
It would be hard to disagree with a call for action plans, especially from Peter Cheese, a companion of the Institute, and Sam Smethers of the Fawcett Society. But a call for action generically is quite easy to say. The difficulty, of course, is what that action should be will vary drastically from organisation to organisation. If you want to affect real change, the only way to really do that is to change how you recruit, select and promote. And all of those things take time. Particularly, ironically, in organisations where people overall are really happy to work there. High levels of engagement, high levels of labour retention, you're not going to have the vacancies where you could start implementing new approaches to recruitment. As the Institute, are in a great position to hear from organisations who are doing or taking action, case studies of where actions have been taken and have actually been successful, and we can publish and promote those. I think by next year we should see a real shift in these gaps, a real closing of them, both the mean and the median, have great stories of how people have affected that change, and finally, as Sam alluded to, not have to even consider explanations and excuses. It's just what we've done to make a difference.
Our second story looks at how businesses can be agile without hurting their staff. A 900 strong coalition of Google temps, vendors and contractors and full-time Google employees has written to the tech giants' leaders demanding fairer treatment for short-term staff. The flashpoint that sparked the missive was a sudden management decision to shorten the contracts of 34 staff in one team. The letter points out that our teammates were told to distance themselves from us at the moment when we were most in need, just so that Google could avoid legal responsibility. For years, Google has boasted of its ability to navigate changes with agility. A whole team thrown into financial uncertainty is what scaling down quickly looks like for Google workers. So what is the human cost of agility? Leadership consultant Dr. Linda Holbeck advises, as a general rule, the task of leaders in agile organisations is to engage people around a broad vision for the future and to focus on building or acquiring capabilities. Command and control styles of leadership are out of sync with the goal of catalysing willing input from employees. She continues, many CEOs struggle to make the shift, to build their own agility and resilience. Leaders have to develop mental toughness, yet also be able to empathise with the people they lead. Is there a way to ensure that staff who enable rapid scale-ups are not subsequently made to feel like they've been taken for granted, Kate?
We take on people on contracts as freelancers, on 0-hour contracts, etc., because they don't have employment rights, essentially. So there is a flexibility about that. So it's very difficult to argue that you're not treating them badly if you suddenly let them go, if their whole livelihood has depended on you as essentially the person who pays them in every way other than contractually their employer. The way to safeguard the interests of those freelance workers is, in my opinion, to make sure that you're not their only employer or their only provider of work, that you encourage them to have a genuine portfolio career so that they're spreading the risk. Because if you're the only person that's paying them, then actually there isn't an ethical case for it being okay. And I think Linda Holbeck's making some good points here, but it's very difficult as a CEO to bring people with you if actually you're not really empathising with their financial situation, and suddenly laying people off or saying we don't need you next week because we're able to do that because of the nature of our contractual relationship, it's not an ethical position.
The era of self-regulation for online companies is over, announced the UK Culture Secretary, Jeremy Wright, last week, as he unveiled the government white paper entitled Online Harms. The paper is a set of proposals for new controls on internet-based firms that allow dangerous content onto their platforms, an amount to the world's first online safety laws. Wright stressed that voluntary actions from industry to tackle online harms have not been applied consistently or gone far enough. He continued, tech can be an incredible force for good, and we want the sector to be part of the solution in protecting their users. However, those that fail to do this will face tough action. The paper explains that the government is exploring options to create new liability for individual senior managers, which could involve personal liability for civil fines, or even extend to criminal liability. It's a tense moment for senior figures in the digital industry, many of whom have relied upon the open web ethos, a free speech defence, and the argument that their sites aren't actually publishers to cushion themselves against liability. So what can CEOs in self-regulated industries learn from this UK web crackdown?
Ideally, we wouldn't want to be regulated because we would be so confident that were regulation to be introduced, that whatever we're doing as a corporate citizen has such integrity that it's beyond reproach. So these companies, I think, for too long have hidden behind the excuse of free speech. And we know free speech is very important to democracy. Nobody's disputing that. But ultimately, that's not their role. They're not there as a platform to ensure that free speech is accessible and available. They're there because they're commercial concerns. So the relationship they have is essentially one with their customers and their other stakeholders. And that's where there has to be real integrity. We have to put the interests of our stakeholders at centre to that relationship and ask ourselves, what is best for those individuals? And if we think about it as a personal relationship, we will want to protect people from being taken advantage of, from their data being used by somewhere else, by being given information and images that are dangerous to their mental health. We would really not have to be regulated. But obviously, regulation is being called for. It's great that the UK are leading the world here. But I think we have to be very careful when we're trying to pinpoint individuals and say they're responsible, as is being suggested, because it's a culture of an organisation that allows poor behaviour, that tolerates less than ideal practices. And that to me is where I'd be really cautious about the individuals concerned, certainly a level lower than CEO.
Thanks, Kate. That's all for now. But if you've enjoyed today's roundup, do subscribe to the series and visit our website at www.institutelm.com, where you'll find lots more useful resources to help leaders and managers to develop. I hope you'll join us next week. See you then.